Welcome to the Unfair Podcast.
Hello, this is Mark Sobel, U.S. Chair OMFIF. Today, OMFIF and I have the great pleasure to be joined by Wally Adeyemos, Deputy Secretary of the U.S. Treasury. Wally worked in the Treasury throughout the Obama administration before moving on to the NSC staff and serving as a U.S. G7 and G20 Sherpa. At Treasury, he was Deputy Chief of Staff for Secretary Geithner and Secretary Liu. One thing I can tell the audience about Wally is he knew everybody in the building, where they were, what they did, and when something needed to get done, he was instrumental in making sure it got done. Immediately prior to rejoining Treasury as Deputy Secretary, he was President of the Obama Foundation. And I should mention that in 2019, you joined me and OMFIF on a podcast about being a Sherpa. So you are an OMFIF veteran today. So I plan to put questions to Wally and then turn to the audience. Audience questions can be submitted via the chat function, and we'll do our best to get to them. So we have plenty to chat about today. Wally, thanks for joining us. Welcome.
Well, Mark, let me say thanks for having me. It's great to be back joining you again. And let me just say personally, a word of thanks to you, because being back at Treasury, it reminds me of all of the times that I spent working with you. And I know that as a young Treasury staffer, I learned a great deal from you and from so many people in this institution. So I am eternally grateful to you for sharing with me your knowledge and for providing me with an opportunity to watch you as you navigated tough issues in that time, and look forward to talking to you today about the challenges and opportunities we face today.
Good, good. Thank you. You're still young, and for that kind, those kind words, I'll make sure to only ask softballs today. All right. So, well, let's do a little scene setting. It's the week of the IMF World Bank spring meetings. Aside from the U.S. economy, you know, what are the Treasury's key messages and objectives? And hopefully we can tick them off and then dig deeper on them.
Yeah, Mark, and I think the truth is that the objective is largely to demonstrate the value of the system that we have all invested a great deal in. As we think about it, the IMF and the World Bank are institutions that were born coming out of World War II in order to promote global prosperity. And the goal of this week is to demonstrate that that system is still the best way to do just that, to provide for global prosperity, but also to demonstrate that in order to take advantage of that system, you have to be willing to live within the rules, norms, and values of that system going forward. And that starts with our first priority, which is addressing Russia's illegitimate invasion of Ukraine. And talking to our allies and partners in the global community about what we collectively need to do to end that invasion, including the tools that we've used that have included sanctions and export controls, but also addressing the crisis that has been created globally by Russia's invasion. As you know well, Ukraine is the breadbasket not only of Europe, but of North Africa and the Middle East. And we've seen an emerging food crisis that has come because Russia is blocking ports in Ukraine and also making it hard for things to move through the Black Sea. So the global community coming together to do that is critically important to us as well during these spring meetings. In addition to doing that, I think the secretary has been very active in trying to demonstrate the power and importance of multilateralism. And a topic of conversation that we are continuing to talk about with the global community is bringing the international tax agreement that was reached last year into force, and the efforts we're taking with our Congress to do so, but also talking to our allies and partners about the work that they're doing there as well. And the two other major global issues that will also be addressed over the course of this week, which include climate change, which, like the last issue I'll mention, pandemic preparedness and global health, is an issue where what we've learned is that it doesn't respect our individual borders or our rules, but rather requires global coordination. And what we have found through the last several decades and today is that ultimately global cooperation is the only way that we can help drive towards the prosperity that we all looked for when we set up these institutions back several decades ago. So those to me are the four major issues: Russia, Ukraine, global tax, climate change, and health security. All of them speak to our need to continue to invest in the system that was created decades ago. And how we do that, we think, is critical to global prosperity going forward.
Well, thanks for that. Well, let's turn first to the U.S. economy, something that will be heavily discussed this week. The U.S. rebounded robustly from the pandemic. Unemployment's under 4%. It was almost 15% at one point. But inflation's very high. Opinion polls suggest Americans are feeling gloomy. Some suggest the Biden administration's rescue plan put more support into the economy than it could handle, adding to inflation, though helping to reduce unemployment. So what's your take on the U.S. economic situation? How's it contrasted with developments abroad? And what would you like to tell Americans, given their gloom?
So, Mark, I think you outlined in a helpful way the strength of the underlying strength of the U.S. economy right now. And I think that it's important for us to recognize that that strength is born of policy choices we've made, but also the strength and determination of the American people. I think the thing we have to acknowledge for every American, but for everyone around the world, is that the last 2 years of dealing with this pandemic have been quite difficult, not only for our economies, which have struggled due to the pandemic, but also in our personal lives. And it's something that we have to acknowledge when we're talking about the economy and talking about global growth, that we continue to deal with a global pandemic. And one of the advantages we have in the United States is that we're further ahead than many other countries in addressing that pandemic because we have gotten the vast majority of adults vaccinated, one. And two, through two successive administrations in Congress, we have provided the economy with resources to help us get through the pandemic in a way that meant that people who were struggling in many ways were made whole and were able to have the resources they needed to be able to get to this point in the pandemic. There's still work for us to do here. And the thing that we recognize about this pandemic, as I said earlier, is that it doesn't respect our borders, but it is a global phenomenon. And that's why we're invested in ensuring that more vaccines get to countries around the world and continue to address the pandemic in a way that helps protect our economy. Today, we're looking at the COVID zero policies in China, and the impact clearly will not only be felt in China and in their economy, but it will have spillovers to the global economy. People often look at spillovers from China being through the growth channel, but as we've learned from the pandemic, you've also seen supply chain issues that come from policies that shut down borders in other countries. What I would say to the American people and what I would say to the audience is that we're very focused on addressing the concerns that Americans have now, which is high costs. But it's important to remember that the reason we have gotten to a point where unemployment is historically low, where American balance sheets are healthier than they've been in decades, where our corporations continue to report earnings that are especially strong, is because we made investments like the American Rescue Plan and other investments in our economy that have allowed us to come into the challenges we face today with a strength of strength, with a source of strength rather than as a source of weakness. And the truth is, the high costs we face in America are being faced all over the world. High energy costs, high food costs, being driven by geopolitical uncertainties from Russia, Ukraine, being driven by COVID reopening, are things that are not only being faced in the United States, but being faced in Europe and being faced in Asia and being faced in Africa and around the world. The difference, though, is that because of the investments we've made and the choices we've made, America comes at these challenges from a source of strength rather than weakness. And what we're doing to try and address those challenges or those high costs are doing things like the president's recent announcement of a historic release of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which is going to add more oil to the market to try and bring down the price of oil over time. And we've taken a number of steps to try and deal with supply chain challenges at places like our ports, by trying to get ports to stay open longer, getting more truck drivers. But ultimately, as you know well, Mark, the Fed has primary responsibility for dealing with inflation, and we are confident in an independent Fed's ability to meet its dual mandate of full employment and also price stability. And we know that they've made clear announcements about what they're going to do. And as the Fed does their part, we're going to use fiscal policy and the tools of the executive branch to make sure that America is well-placed going forward to remain a source of strength for the global economy at a time when we face challenges like China's COVID zero policy and Russia's continued invasion of Ukraine.
Well, thank you. Let's turn to the unprecedented and extraordinary actions taken by the U.S. and its allies against Russia. Huge praise to you and the administration for the fast, impactful action and for doing so with tremendous cooperation from our allies. For many years, analysts generally tended to doubt the efficacy of sanctions. In October, Treasury released a sanctions review in which you played a major part. Congratulations on that and its emphasis on multilateralism and a strategic policy framing to make financial sanctions work effectively. So many say Russia is still earning substantial oil revenue and that sanctions aren't stopping the fighting. Do you think that your actions against Russia show that financial sanctions work, that the dollar's global role can be an important lever? And picking up on observations from your ex-boss, Jack Lew, how do you think about guarding the dollar's global financing role when using financial sanctions?
All very great questions, Mark. And let me just start from something you said, which is the partnerships that we developed. And you're right that when Secretary Yellen asked me to conduct this review of U.S. sanctions policy, one of the things that I did was talk to our allies and partners about what they thought had worked and what they thought the most important lessons were that we had learned that would be helpful to us going forward with regard to implementing sanctions. At that point, we had no clue that Russia would invade Ukraine, but the lessons we learned out of that review were quite helpful to us in terms of being prepared for the actions we needed to take in response to Russia's invasion. And the relationships and conversations that started during the review were relationships and conversations that we picked up again in November when we started to see through intelligence that Russia was amassing troops at Ukraine's border. And fundamentally, the president made very clear to us that he wanted us to immediately start to think through not only what we would do in the United States if Russia were to invade Ukraine, but what we would do in collaboration and coordination with our closest allies. So the initial policy response was one to try and build a coalition rather than to think about what we would do on a go-alone basis. I think to your question about the dollar, one of the things that we do to maintain the dollar status is to demonstrate that the system, that when we use sanctions, we're attempting to do them in a multilateral way. And you look at the central bank sanctions that we levied against Russia. The truth is that Russia, after the 2014 invasion of Crimea and the sanctions we levied at that point, moved $80 billion of their reserve assets out of the United States and had parked most of their reserve assets in Europe. So in order for us to have the kind of impact we've had on Russia's economy, it was critical that Europe joined us in the actions that we took. And not only Europe, but also the owners of the world's other major convertible currencies taking actions also limited Russia's ability to think about where they would go in the future in terms of placing reserves, but also for thinking through how they manage their economy. And the truth, and when you look at this, it's something that their central bank governor made clear just a few days ago when she testified in front of their lower house and was asked what they can do to try and evade our sanctions. And she made very clear that it was nearly impossible to find means to get around our sanctions, not because they weren't trying, but rather because it wasn't just the U.S., it wasn't just the dollar, but rather it was work that we had done with the G7 countries and with 23 other countries that had joined our alliance going forward. So I think the most important thing we can do when it comes to sanctions in terms of protecting the role of the dollar in the global economy is to try and multilateralize our sanctions whenever possible. But ultimately, I think the dollar's role in the global economy is driven by far more than just our sanctions policy. It comes down to what we do in terms of the investments we make in the United States, making sure that we maintain the deepest, most liquid markets in the world, making investments in our country to make it more competitive. When I travel the world, one of the questions people ask me most about is about our infrastructure bill. and how they can find ways to think about investing in the United States, given that our economy is going to be more competitive going forward. So I think that we're, in addition to thinking very rigorously about how we use sanctions and doing things like doing the economic analysis to make sure that the sanctions we put in place have a greater impact on the adversary rather than ourselves and our allies, we also need to be thoughtful about what we do in terms of going forward, in terms of our investments in the global economy. And I think that gets us to energy. And when the president talked about the imposition of a ban on Russian energy in the United States, he made very clear that Europe was differently situated because we're a net exporter of energy because of investments and choices we've made in this country, many of which were made in the Obama administration, many of which continue through the Trump administration, but continue through our administration that have allowed us to be a net exporter. And the president's made clear that we want to continue to provide energy to the global economy in order to make sure that we're in a place where we have affordability in terms of global energy. But Europe, as you know, is very differently situated. They're far more reliant on energy from Russia, but they've made a commitment as well to reduce that reliance as quickly as possible. A few weeks ago, they made the decision that they were going to ban Russian coal, which was an important announcement that demonstrated their commitment to taking these steps. In addition to the canceling of Nord Stream 2, Europe is doing everything they can to move off of Russian energy as quickly as possible. And our goal is to make sure that as a reliable partner and ally that we can help them in taking those steps, because our ultimate goal is to try and deny the Kremlin the revenues they need to project power into the future. What we've done so far with our sanctions regime is force them into a choice between using the resources they have today to prop up their economy or to fund their war of choice in Ukraine. And they're using a lot of resources to prop up their economy. For example, forcing exporters to bring dollars and euros home and to turn them into rubles. Also announcing stimulus plans to try and keep the economy propped up. And while they continue to bring in dollars and euros and other resources, the other thing we're very focused on now is also using our sanctions regime to go after their military industrialized complex and their supply chain. A few weeks ago, their defense minister held a public meeting, and people paid attention to the fact that it was a public meeting and the first one he had held in weeks. But the thing that I paid attention to and my colleagues paid attention to was the subject of the meeting, and it was on procurement. Given how well the Ukrainians had fought with the help of the resources we provided to them and how poorly Russia has done, they need to resupply their military. And our goal now is to make sure that we use sanctions and export controls to make that as hard to impossible as possible going forward. And I think doing those two things in terms of finding ways to deny them of resources coming in by reducing dependence on their energy and to frustrating their efforts to resupply, we think are the best things we can do at the moment to help support Ukraine as they try to end Russia's war of choice in their country.
Thanks. Well, let's switch gears a little bit to China. So one hears in D.C. these days that we are in a period of strategic competition with China. Proponents of that view sometimes argue that engagement would Proponents of that view suggest that those who have argued that engagement would make China more cooperative and open have been proven wrong. Treasury was pivotal in U.S.-China engagement under Secretary Snow, Paulson, Geithner, and Liu. Competitive or not, China and the U.S. share interests in a smoothly functioning global economic and financial system. Climate issues have to be tackled. We really need to do more on debt distress in low-income countries caused in part by unsustainable Chinese lending. So it seems to me that if the U.S. and China we should engage if for no other reason than to lessen the possibility of bad outcomes, and that doing so would not be inconsistent with the eyes wide open strategic competitive view of China. So how does Treasury see that?
Well, this is an easy one. I completely agree with you, Mark. And I think the truth is that China, more so than almost any country, has benefited from the global system that's been created. Millions of Chinese individuals have been raised out of poverty. China's economy has flourished due to this system. They continue to benefit from this system. And ultimately, to solve some of the biggest challenges that China faces, they need to work with the world. You look at COVID and the public health crisis that's created. It's not only a crisis in China, it's a global crisis. The only way that China knows that it can be solved is by working with the rest of the world. You look at climate change. I remember being in Beijing and seeing the impacts of climate change there, as you saw brown snow kind of falling to the ground. And I think you, again, that's a place where China working closely with the global community is going to be critical, including the United States. And I think ultimately it is to both of our countries' benefits to work on a range of issues together as part of a larger global community going forward. But I think even in areas where we have competition, the key is going to have to make sure that that competition takes place on a level playing field, ensuring that we're playing by the same rules of the road. And I think that is the place where we're going to have to continue to have conversations, and we'll have to like manage our conflict with China. But my sense is that this is not just a U.S.-China issue. It's a China global issue, because the same competitiveness that we seek to have with China is a competitiveness that companies and economies in Europe want, and companies and economies in Asia want. And the goal is that for China to not only enjoy the privileges of being part of this global system, but also to make sure that they play, that they address the legitimate concerns that countries have with regard to the ways that they manage their economy internally. I think you can do both of those things, working together on the crisis, on the challenges we face globally, while also addressing the legitimate issues that other economies in the global economy have with the way China has managed its economy, and in lots of ways has done so in a way that creates competitive disadvantages for countries around the world. My view is that this is what we have to do in order to make sure that we're in a place where our workers and our companies are able to have fair access, not only to China, but to global markets around the world, but at the same time, ensuring that our country and the global economy is protected from some of the downside risks that come from crises like the pandemic, climate change, and a number of other national security issues that we have to work with China and the rest of the world on addressing.
Okay, well, let me switch gears again, and let me put a last question to you, and then we'll take on the audience questions. And it's probably not the question you often get these days, but so Dodd-Frank created the Financial Stability Oversight Council to identify and tackle risk to our financial system. It's something you worked heavily on in your earlier days at Treasury. I worked on the Financial Stability Board, and we had to align what we did with where the U.S. was headed on Dodd-Frank. So undoubtedly, the FSOC is working on crypto assets, stable coins, questions about digital currencies and the like. There was the President's Working Group report on stable coins. I know FSOC is studying climate risks. I had a good session with John Morton a few months ago. And also during the crisis and the pandemic, we saw that non-bank financial intermediation still posed major risk to our financial system and thus to our economy. We regulated the banks, and activity gravitated towards non-banks, creating the potential for gaps. So can you tell us a little bit about the role the FSOC is playing these days, particularly in these digital climate non-bank areas?
Yeah, I think, Mark, you hit on a number of the key priorities for FSOC, and our undersecretary, Nelly Yang. Nelly has been playing a key role here in terms of driving our policy when it comes to the FSOC. And I think the goal for us has been to try and do four things that fall into, I'd say, two buckets. One is continue to pay a great deal of attention to the traditional financial system to ensure that risk there is not growing in ways that we don't see. But also, as you've mentioned, to look at the non-bank financial sector, where because we, through Dodd-Frank, did a great deal to regulate the traditional financial system, a lot of risk is potentially migrated. Crypto is definitely an issue that we are spending a great deal of time thinking about. And I think the key and the way I would put this is to say that we're thinking broadly about digital assets. Crypto is one, an important one, but we need to think more broadly about the ecosystem of digital assets and what this means in terms of financial stability. And while we're thinking about financial stability, there are a number of other issues that other parts of the Treasury Department are also thinking about that also matter a great deal when it comes to digital assets. As you know, the President put out an EO that spoke to these issues, and Treasury is responsible for a number of reports. But in addition to thinking about digital assets, financial, climate-related financial risk is another place where we're focused, largely because the thing that we fear is that when we don't understand the type of risk that something like climate change presents, it potentially creates huge financial stability risk for the economy as we think about transitions. But thinking also about more traditional issues like treasury market resiliency, which speaks to an issue we talked about earlier. How do we make sure that America's markets remain the deepest, most liquid markets in the world is critical to ensuring the dollar remains the global reserve currency going forward. So it's an important issue. And then finally, financial intermediation and how this works is critical to ensuring not only that financial institutions and big corporations are able to continue to fund their operations, but ultimately when you think about financial intermediation at its most basic level, it's critical to making sure that any kind of cross-border payments are made, including remittances. So I'd say those are the places where we're focused. And I think the key for us is always to make sure that FSOC is being thoughtful about what the future looks like. Oftentimes, what I found as a policymaker is our biggest failure often is our failure is a failure of imagination to think about where risk may exist or what could lead to certain outcomes is often the thing that most catches you by surprise. So I think just the creation of the Financial Stability Oversight Council, a group that is focused on thinking about those risks, has been critical to better preparing us to deal with the challenges that the financial system can present for our, to our economy.
Thank you. And I just want to echo that your point, Nellie Lang, is wonderful. Okay, well, we spoke a bit about the dollar. You emphasized the multilateral nature of the sanctions, which I agree with you is absolutely critical. But we have received a few questions wishing to go a bit deeper. Are you concerned about the precedent that has been set with respect to freezing central bank assets? On top of it, there's talk about confiscating Russian assets and mobilizing them for Ukraine. And then others wondering, are you worried about fragmented payment systems and the like, and what that might bode for the future role of the dollar? So do you have any thoughts on those?
My view is that ultimately the key for us is to make sure that whatever is done, both in response to Russia, Ukraine, but also in terms of the use of this system for advancing both prosperity, but also holding rogue nations accountable, need to be done in a principle-based manner. How do we think about the principles here that have been violated and how do we respond to it? Ultimately, the system that we created was one that was built on a set of rules, norms, and values. And what we have communicated clearly to Russia is that invading a sovereign country is something that violates those rules, norms, and values. And one of the critical things for us and principles that the president had set out was the importance of working not just as the United States, but working with a large coalition in a multilateral way to ensure that we sent a clear message to Russia, but to others that ultimately taking steps like this, you will be held accountable to do them. I'm not going to talk about what we may do in the future in terms of Russian assets, but what I will say is that the decision to freeze Russia's central bank assets was not one that was reached lightly. It was in response to Russia's illegitimate invasion of Ukraine, something that all of us remember Russia said that they were not going to do, something that has largely now led to spillover effects that don't only impact peace and stability in Ukraine, but has led to higher energy and food prices around the world and has led to instability that will have global repercussions. I think it's important for us to remember that Russia was the one that violated the principles that we had all agreed to. And it's important for us when someone does that to hold them accountable in certain ways. And that's why ultimately these group of countries decided to take these actions with regard to Russia's central bank assets. But the thing that I'll say about sanctions policy as well is that one of the things that we found in the review that we conducted that was it's also important that you make very clear to adversaries what they can do to stop or reverse sanctions that you've put in place. And what we've made very clear is that we're going to continue to use sanctions and export controls until Russia's invasion of Ukraine stops and potentially reverses. I think that's been a very clear message, because ultimately our goal here is not for punishment. It's really to put us in a place where we can stop the Kremlin's ability to project power and to create instability, not just in Europe, but around the world. When it comes to alternative payment systems, I think, again, this speaks to a point that we talked about earlier, where my view is that the benefits of a system that we have created, the one that a financial system that has integrated the world, are far greater than the creation of alternative networks. There are going to be alternative routes of payment. Some of them will be small. People look at crypto as potentially one of those. But even when you look at crypto or digital assets, ultimately, somebody who owns one of those, a token or something else, they often want to off-ramp or on-ramp using a fiat currency. And the fiat currencies they want to use are the currencies that are the easiest to use, the convertible global currencies, the dollar, the yen, the euro, the pound sterling. I think as long as we continue to build the traditional system and to invest in it and to make sure that its benefits are greater than its burdens, I expect that any alternative system will be quite modest in scale and in scope, because there is so much value created by doing business with the countries that are part of the traditional system. It's a traditional networking effect. And as long as that network remains stronger than the alternative, it'll continue to stand. You look at where the IMF started. I think when the IMF was created, it had, maybe 29 members at that point. Today, the IMF includes 190 countries. The reason countries joined the IMF over time was because it was in their interest. And the key for us has got to be using the spring meetings now, but using our gatherings over time to ensure that the system that we've built continues to have the benefits that attract countries to it rather than to its alternative.
Thank you. You know, I've had some interviews with Danny Glaser, who was a sanction expert, and he always stresses that when financial sanctions are undertaken multilaterally and as part of a strategy, that they can be very effective and not damaging. And the point I always make is that if the key risk to the dollar's future is the behavior of the United States, and we need to be responsible stewards of our economy, the dollar will remain vibrant. Another good question has come in about Ukraine and its financing needs, totally apart from the military angle. It's going to need massive resources for reconstruction. That money's going to have to be organized somehow. Can you tell us about what the U.S. is thinking about doing for Ukraine? I saw the G7 had a $24 billion figure yesterday in a communique. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'm happy to. And I, right before this, just finished a meeting with Secretary Yellen, with the Prime Minister of Ukraine and the Finance Minister, where we discussed this topic. But just to follow up on what you just said about financial sanctions, and I should have led with this, is that one other thing that we found is that financial sanctions are the most successful when they're part of a broader foreign policy strategy. Sanctions ultimately are just a tool. That tool needs to be in service of a broader strategy. And I think that's why the president making very clear to us early on that he wanted this to be multilateral. And it included not just sanctions, but also diplomacy, and also some of the other assistance that we provided to Ukraine is what ultimately will make, we hope, this foreign policy strategy successful. But that's got to be true of future sanctions as well, because that's, as you said, Mark, ultimately the thing that will keep the dollar in its role in the global economy are the choices we make in the United States. And those choices being driven by a strategy is critical to us going forward. To the question of financial support for Ukraine, as I mentioned, we just met with the Prime Minister before this conversation, and Secretary Yellen made clear to him that we're going to provide Ukraine with $1 billion of support from the United States nearly immediately. We're committed to continuing to work with Congress to find ways to continue to support Ukraine's economic needs. Later today, the Secretary and I will be joining leaders from finance ministries around the world for a conference being hosted by the World Bank to talk about how we can help meet Ukraine's immediate needs. And the way I think about Ukraine's needs at the moment is to think about what are their immediate budgetary needs to make sure that they can meet payments to pensioners, to civil servants, to other people, to keep the economy running while they continue to fight to end Russia's war of aggression in Ukraine. But Ukraine is going to have a far larger need over time to reconstruct the country. And that's going to require bilateral assistance, but also multilateral assistance from some of the international financial institutions and some of the other entities around the world. That's something that we need to think about and talk about and plan for. But at the moment, our goal is to make sure that we meet their immediate budgetary needs to support them as they continue to fight off Russian aggression within their territory. We've been in contact with the finance ministry and the IMF and the World Bank, and we look to the IMF and World Bank to help us figure out what the numbers look like over the short term, working closely with Ukraine. And the United States wants to play its role, but what we found and what we learned from past episodes is that ultimately pulling together a bilateral package is going to be something that's going to be critically led by working closely with the international financial institutions. And that's what we're going to start doing today. Over the last several years, we provided a great deal of assistance to Ukraine's economy. This is different, and it's going to be different in scale. And while we're going to be willing to do the bilateral work and also work with CFEs, later tonight, I'm going to be hosting a dinner with the Ukrainian finance minister and some leaders in the U.S. business community, because I honestly think that we've also got to have the private sector play a role here as well, because the thing that Ukraine wants to do, which is essential to Ukraine's future, is to build a prosperous private sector that will allow their economy to generate the kind of growth that will be needed to ensure that Ukraine remains a sustainable, important country in Europe going forward. That has got to be our goal, because ultimately, we need to demonstrate that Russia's aggression will not be met by the retreat of the official sector or our bilateral assistance or the private sector, frankly.
So I had a question about Secretary Yellen's speech a week ago, where she expressed support for friendshoring of supply chains to a large number of trusted countries. And the question is, what does this mean in practice? Is there a definition of a trusted country? Where does that leave China, since China is central to many global value chains? Is it untrusted or trusted, or can it be trusted? And how will that impact the global economy? So anyway, there are more squiggles in the question, but I think that kind of puts it to you.
Yeah, and I think that COVID-19 and the crisis, the economic crisis that it created, has focused our minds on the importance of supply chain resiliency. My expectation early on in COVID-19 was that it would force companies to, in many ways, think through and rethink some of their supply chains in order to make sure that they're more resilient. They had the ability to move from one jurisdiction to another quite easily, which in some ways will increase the cost of the supply chain, but will also reduce the risk that supply chain will be disrupted. And much of that, I thought, would be driven by what the public health challenge had revealed to a number of these companies. But in addition to the public health challenge, that the other challenge that I think a number of companies and countries, frankly, have been wrestling with is the security of supply chains for critical materials, but also critical supplies going forward. And the question being whether you can rely on countries with which you are in competition, or countries where there is a lack of transparency. to be reliable suppliers of goods that are critical to your economy going forward. And the way that I think about this is, how do you set a high standard for supply chains that are critical to your economy and critical to your national security? That includes transparency, reliability, the ability of companies to be able to call on suppliers to meet their commitments over time. And my sense of this is that as people come out of not only COVID-19, but also the challenges that we've seen in with regard to supply chains coming out of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, companies and countries are going to be more focused on making sure that they build up resiliency, especially in countries where those things, where trust, reliability, and the ability to call upon commitments exists. Doing this in a more organized way, I think, is something that we're likely to see. But I think that when I think about friendshoring, that's how I think about it.
Okay, with time running out, I'm going to ask you one last question. It's a very Sobel-like question. So I spent a lot of my career working on the G7. And we kind of realized in the 2000s, the 7 didn't have the clout to steer the global economy. We had a global financial crisis, and we kind of shifted to a G20 world. You and I spent many hours on planes going to G20 meetings. Now, but the ground has shifted under the G20. We saw Russia's invasion of Crimea. We've seen China become more assertive and aggressive, and we saw the Trump administration. We've seen that outside of China, the BRICS didn't perform that well. And so now you have Russia, Ukraine, and with U.S., China. So the 20 is disrupted. But that leaves questions about global governance and how you steer things forward. How do you steer global governance forward if you have a 7, which is good among a small group for things like sanctions and crypto and cyber, but not for the broader steering, and you have a broader steering group which isn't able to do so these days?
It's a great question. And on a lighter note, last night I had dinner with someone we both know, Trish Pollard, and she was talking about some of our trips to G20 meetings, and especially to Australia, and how hard and how far it was from the United States. It was just a reminder of, I think the reality is that at the Treasury Department and at finance ministries around the world, there are these dedicated public servants who are working to advance the agendas of these various bodies. And many of them this week are working extra overtime as we deal with the spring meetings of the IMF and World Bank. And I just want to, on behalf of all of the ministers and deputy ministers, thank them for the extraordinary work that they do on a regular basis. But to your question, Mark, you mentioned the G7, but I think the key thing for us to do is to also realize that the G7 at one point was the G8. It included Russia. There was a decision made to remove Russia from the then G8 and turn it back into the G7. And while you're right that the G20 covers more of the global economy and is more diverse, the G7 still represents a huge part of the global economy. Has the ability not only to set policy when it comes to things like sanctions, but I would argue that the G7 meeting hosted by the UK was critical to unlocking progress on the global minimum tax. And I think that the way I've thought about this is oftentimes getting to an agreement amongst your closest allies is critical to building agreement around the world on a number of critical issues. But to the G20, I think the even before Russia, Ukraine, the G20 was created in many ways a long time ago. And as you know, it was a finance ministry led process for a long time that was elevated to a leaders led process during the financial crisis that we faced here in the United States. And my sense is that ultimately the G20 remains a critical forum because it represents so many critical economies in the world, but it is a harder place to get things done. But when they do get done, it is quite useful to moving forward. The example that I always turn back to was during the Obama administration. One of the things we were focused on doing was getting entry into force of the Paris Climate Agreement. And while this was not squarely in the G20's court because it was an issue that was being driven by the UN, we knew that in order to bring this into force, it would require us to get a number of the G20 countries aligned in this. And we used the G20 as an opportunity to have those conversations, not only on the sidelines of the G20 leaders meeting, but also as an opportunity to talk about the importance of all these countries coming together to solve some of the biggest global challenges we had. So I still maintain that there is a need for an economic forum like the G20, where major economies around the world can get around the table to solve global challenges. It is hard to solve regional ones in some cases, or those that involve countries within the G20. When you think about issues like climate change, global taxation, the pandemic, these are all issues that those countries that are gathered around that table of the G20 care deeply about, because they recognize that they're challenges they can't solve within their borders. So it is in their national interest to work collaboratively. And when there are economic issues, they're often easier to deal with in a body like the G20 than in some kind of UN setting, frankly. And to use the G20 as a setting to drive a momentum and progress for major global issues like that. So I do agree that at the current moment, things at the G20 have changed, and we're going to have to work out the modalities of what that change looks like. But I think the experience of seeing what happened with the G8 to the G7 leaves me with hope and an understanding that a way to continue to use these bodies to advance our shared global priorities.
Thank you. I agree. The 7 has its utility, the 20 has its utility, and ad hoc groupings have their utility, and you need to exploit all of them, and it gets more complicated the messier things are. I remember the plane trip from Australia, sitting across from Wally Adeyemo, and I have to say that Wally is super talented, but there's an extremely talented Treasury team behind him. He mentioned one of them, and they're fantastic, and they won't speak to me if I don't say that. And lastly, I need to let you go. You've got important things to do. I want to thank you for joining us today. Thanks to Wally Adeyemo, Deputy Secretary of the U.S. Treasury.
Thanks for having me, Mark, and thanks for everything that you do.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.